Listen, the birds sing. Listen, the bells ring. All the living are dead, and the dead are all living. The war is over, and we are beginning.
Chapter 4. Steve laughs actual, genuine laughter as he goes through the trunk of all his remaining possessions. The stacks of notebooks filled with sketches and Bucky's startling collection of pulps aren't particularly funny. He's just so goddamn delighted to have something back from their life together. So he pulls Bucky's favourite sweater out of the trunk, smelling all dusty and musty, and he laughs. The night before he shipped out with the USO to Europe, he and Rachel packed up everything into boxes, all shoved into the back of the closet. And it's nearly all here. Apparently, his drafting tools, and some of his more benign art, was donated to the Smithsonian sometime in the 60s. But the rest is here. A couple of rosaries, a dinky little menorah, the chipped white and blue ceramic bowl, where they'd throw their loose change in at the end of the day. The rest of their belongings are scattered throughout the girl's home, integrated seamlessly into the decor of the apartment. His mother's landscapes hang in the guest room in the hallway, her vases in Beck's office. A photograph of Bucky with Steve and Beck out on the front steps of the Barnes's new brownstone in Park Slope sits on the mantel. Next to it is a candid taken at the bar, with Steve drawing at the counter, Rachel and Bucky talking animatedly about something in the background. Steve gets to spend the night in a room with his mother's art lining the walls. Good night, Steve, Rachel murmurs as they part ways in the hall. She tugs on the collar of his shirt, and he bends down so she can kiss his cheek. I love you very much. Welcome home. For the first time in the 21st century, Steve sleeps through the night, and he doesn't dream. In the morning, he cuts up fruit for breakfast, and he doesn't ask any more questions about all the years he's missed. He's still raw and wrung out from the night before, and he might feel almost content after a good night's sleep, but it's still overwhelming. Even without asking questions, he picks up bits and pieces. Rachel made a living designing dresses for society ladies and drag queens alike, somehow. Beck was a professor and wrote a whole bunch of books. They have money now. This home, the one that gives queer kids with no families a safe place to live, is their legacy, and they're both fiercely proud of it. Rachel still starts her day with a prayer in Hebrew. Beck still frowns over everything, but she's got nothing but soft smiles for her wife. And that's what Rachel is. Her wife. Rachel has a wife. Steve could have a... Well, no. He couldn't. Marriage laws have changed since his time, but Bucky's still dead. Steve makes breakfast. Apparently, when Steve isn't taking up residence in their guest room, there's a woman that comes up a couple times a day to do this sort of thing. A nurse who spends part of her time up here helping the girls stick to their elaborate regime of medications, and the rest of her time working with the kids downstairs. Her name is Mia. She's also got a wife, Olive, the one who runs the home. Rachel chatters about everything Mia does, and Steve realizes for the first time that she and Beck are old. Extremely old. Far older than most people made it back in their day. Rachel struggles to stay focused and repeats herself, forgetting after only a few minutes what she's just told Steve. Beck can't get out of bed by herself some mornings, and she spends most of her days in a chair, hooked up to an oxygen tank. Rebecca reminds Steve of 1933, when he was so weak he had to rely on Bucky and his mother to feed him, clothe him, even bathe him. He was furious, with his own deficient body and a crippling shame that he couldn't do the smallest tasks for himself. Bucky and Ma took care of him, loved him, and in return Steve let his fury spill over onto them, with scathing comments, complete ingratitude, and sometimes even yelling. Beck is handling the whole thing with a lot more grace than Steve did. "I got used to it," Beck says, when she catches Steve frowning at her wheelchair as he slices a peach. "My body's been crumbling since I was 75, and for a while there I was a right pill about needing the help. But it upset Rachel, me snapping at her or snapping at the caregivers. So I shut up until I got used to it. Not so bad, Steve-o. I'd rather have my body useless than my mind gone." Steve refills her mug of coffee. "When'd you get so wise, huh?" Beck snorts. 90 years of living will do that to you." "You're 88, says Rachel. "Don't exaggerate." When he reaches for the bananas to add to the fruit salad, Beck says, "Trust me, you don't want to go there." Steve shrugs and keeps putting together breakfast. Rachel suggests fruit and toast, but tells Steve he needs protein, directing him towards the eggs and bacon in the icebox. He knows that rationing is long over, that people of the 21st century don't have to live around food shortage, and that Rachel and Beck seem to be richer than God, although not quite as rich as Tony Stark. Still, the sight of so much bacon makes his heart race and his mouth water. "You eat bacon now?" he asks. "No, sir," Rachel gasps theatrically, like she's mortally offended. "Beck likes it. Cook it in the green pan." "You're so good to me, darling." "Aw, thank you, Rebecca." "I was talking to Steve," Beck quips. "He's the one doing the cooking." Rachel laughs and swats Beck in the arm with a rolled-up newspaper before she goes back to reading it with the assistance of a very large magnifying glass. Just being near Beck and Rachel, listening to them bicker while he prepares breakfast, it's the first little peace he's had in this century. Bucky was always better than him at cooking, but Rachel grew up behind a deli counter, and she talks him through it from her seat at the kitchen table. Bacon sizzles, and Steve breathes deep, groaning over the smell. They eat on the balcony. It's a huge space, big enough for a table that seats six, some sofas surrounding a fireplace, and a couple chairs designed for lounging around and napping in the sun. There are all manners of flowers in boxes that hang over the edge of the railing, and vines crawl up the brick walls. Throughout breakfast, Steve keeps glancing over the railing, expecting Shield to roll up and yell at him about wandering away on his own. Maybe they can't find him. More likely, they know exactly where he is, and have decided to give him some space, to treat him like a person instead of a symbol, and just let him be for a minute. After breakfast, the girls follow him to the kitchen to watch him do the dishes. "So what's next for you?" Rachel asks. She sounds like a fucking journalist, like the SHIELD officials trying to get him to sign up with them, and like Tony Stark, already starting plans to remodel an entire floor of the tower, just for Steve, in the hopes that he'll stay. Steve squeezes a coffee mug in his hands, surprised to feel it shatter in his grip. He keeps his back turned to the girls, so they won't see the blood. Running water over the cuts, he watches as they close up before his eyes. "I don't mean to push you," Rachel continues, oblivious to Steve's wounds, but not to his sudden distress. "And we don't want anything from you. But, please, just know you're welcome here any time. All the time, if you want. Any time at all. We want you to be wherever you want to be. And if that place is here, well, good. Then be here." "Okay," says Steve, relaxing slightly. They don't want anything from him. It's been a long time since someone wanted him around for reasons outside propaganda and war. "Thanks." He still leaves an hour later, determined to go back into the city and be useful, explaining to Rachel as she walks him to the door. "Aliens," he says, pausing in the entryway, from outer space. Can you believe it?
No.
Rachel shakes her head, chuckling. But I still can't really believe that you went from my tiny best friend to a hulking national icon. I'm still your best friend, Rach. She beams up at him and says, You're my family, too. Yeah, he agrees, his throat tight. Steve loiters, with his hands on the door handle. Despite being antsy to get back into the city, he's suddenly hesitant to leave Rachel again. I'm really here, somehow. That's another thing I can't believe, he says. Me neither, Rachel whispers. And of course I'd wake up just to go to war with aliens. Rachel winces. Unfortunately, it's not just the aliens. Wars don't end like they used to, Bubile. But our war did. His voice sounds small, more Brooklyn than Captain America. That's what they all told me. It did, Rachel assures him. It led right into a couple different ones, but it ended, with treaties and our boys coming home and everything. How? Asks Steve, knowing full well Rachel won't have his answers, when he's not even totally sure what he's asking. Was it worth it? He doesn't ask. What does winning look like? What? You want, like, specific military operations? Because I don't know enough to tell you. I guess, says Steve. Rachel suddenly gets very quiet and very sad, her face twisted with grief. Steve braces himself for the next great, painful revelation. There's been so many since he woke up. Steve, she whispers. Did they tell you about Japan? Steve takes a deep breath. Just that they surrendered. I don't want to tell you why. Rachel. No, she says, shaking her head. It's too much. You were frozen for 70 years, Steve. Bucky only died 48 days ago to you. And now you're here and so much has happened. It's too much. You're going to be so, so disappointed. He takes a deep breath. Just tell me. She stares up at him, studying him intently. She takes his hand, and her voice wavers as she speaks. Bombs. Atomic bombs. Dropped on Hiroshima, and then, several days later, Nagasaki. Several hundred thousand dead, many more to go later from the radiation. So you're telling me, Steve says, struggling to comprehend, that a couple months after I crashed a plane full of bombs into the Arctic to stop them from demolishing the eastern seaboard, we turned around and did the same thing to Japan? Yes, Rachel whispers. Jesus Christ! Rachel does not want him to leave after that. She says he's too pale, that he shouldn't be alone. But Steve desperately needs to haul around huge slabs of concrete, 10 times his body weight, do anything that will actually cause a real strain in his muscles. Distractions. He needs distractions. So he kisses her cheek and promises to come back for dinner, and somehow keeps from throwing up until he's 2 blocks away. He empties his stomach right there in a rather lovely flower bed, 10 pieces of bacon and all. Later, after cleaning up another city block and checking to make sure Tony Stark's still alive in his lab, Director Fury sits him down and says, We still need you, Cap. We dropped atomic bombs on Japan in 1945. Steve says, getting some sick pleasure out of Fury's wince. What the fuck have we been doing since then, huh? Director Fury stares him down, but his intense look ain't half as effective as Winnie's was. Steve doesn't even blink. "Our best," he says. "We've done our best." When Steve leaves to go back to Brooklyn, Fury doesn't stop him. He's only been back to the bar 4 times, usually during the day, but also once at night when Bucky had a date. 4 times, and he's already learned a lot about Rachel Rosenbaum. She's a Jew. She's from the Lower East Side, growing up in the kitchen of the restaurant her parents ran. She practices smoothing out her accent, but sometimes the Yiddish comes out, and she sounds like Bucky's bubbe. Sully is not actually her uncle, but her father's childhood best friend. She grew up calling him Uncle Sully, but when she was 11 he stopped coming round, and she heard her parents whispering about his perversions. During the week she serves drinks at Sully's bar, even though she's at least a few years too young for it. On the weekends, she apprentices with a tailor in Williamsburg. She wants to design her own dresses, and spends too much money on Vogues when she can manage it, much to Sully's disgruntlement. Between pouring drinks, Rachel shares all these pieces of herself, ready and willing to be his friend, even when he gives her nothing in return. Steve sits at the bar with a sketchbook, and can't even bring himself to tell her his last name, or about Bucky, or about his WPA job. Rachel doesn't seem to mind, perfectly content to fill the gaps where his response should be, with chatter of her own. She tells him the secrets to perfect matzo ball soup, and complains that Sully won't even try to dress a little more dapper, even on the rare weekend that the bar hosts slightly more glamorous parties for drag queens. She tells him that she ran away from home when she was 15, after years of arguing with her mother about finding a nice Jewish husband, and that she doesn't miss her parents, but she misses the cadence of Yiddish, and her long-dead bubbe, and Hebrew school. Her voice gets very quiet and weepy when she talks about her grandmother, the one who raised her when her own mother was uninterested in parenting. The one who still loved her, even after she confessed at 8 years old that she would never want a husband, but a wife might be okay. Today, when Rachel gets a minute to talk to him after sweeping the whole bar, she tells him how she kissed her best friend on 4 separate occasions under the ruse of practicing for their future husbands. Steve is so close to opening his mouth and telling his own story. He almost says, "I kissed my best friend on the day my mother was diagnosed with TB. Or maybe he kissed me. It's impossible to remember. But we don't do that anymore." Instead, he chokes on a mouthful of beer, and Rachel leans across the bar to smack his crooked back, laughing. "Well, blow me down with a feather," says Rachel, getting a good look at Steve's open sketchbook when he finally gets a handle on the coughing. He likes coming here to draw, when the apartment feels too stuffy and closed in for creativity. He got a good amount of work done today, and has been messing around with shading on a portrait of Rachel working for the last 30 minutes, just for fun. "Is that me?" she asks. "Azoy?" Steve jerks on his stool and flails to cover the drawing, but it's too late. Rachel's caught him. "Sorry." Steve panics as Rachel gets the notebook away from him, holding it aloft to stare better. "I should have asked. It's just a doodle." "Doodle?" Rachel says, aghast. "You take that back." "Sorry?" "You're really good," she says, looking at Steve like she's just seeing him for the first time. "This is only a doodle? Hell, Stephen, what can you do when you're actually trying?" "You saw me outside the art center," Steve says, ears turning red. "Yeah, well, I was thinking you were a student like me, just trying to figure out the lead end of a pencil. This is art. You're an artist." Rachel's got this way of making the complicated way Steve sees himself sound so very simple. "You're an artist," she says. "You're queer," she says. And before her, he's never been able to think of himself as either of those things. Artists are the guys who can paint giant masterpieces with oils, or craft sculptures so awesome it makes your breath catch in your throat. Guys who have no trouble seeing colours, who don't cough for hours after inhaling just a little charcoal dust, who don't have to take months off in the winter just to survive an illness. Guys with vision. Guys with something to say. Queer has always been just fine for everyone else. Steve would never judge someone for it. Never think of them as perverts or disgusting delinquents. But he's never had the same grace for himself. He's tried the label on in his head, called himself Queer Steve Rogers as he looked in a mirror. But he can't do it without feeling sick with shame. There are echoes in his mind of every bully who ever called him a shrimp, a girl, a fairy. But why shouldn't it be as simple as Rachel says it? He can take a pencil to a piece of paper and create something that looks more realistic than a photograph. He likes boys the same way he likes girls, and the WPA is paying him a weekly salary for his art. He's been in love with his best friend for years. It's that simple. Artist. Queer. "Do you mind?" Rachel asks, moving to turn the page in his sketchbook. And maybe before Steve decided to make it simple, he'd have said no. But he's an artist, and he's queer, so he's not ashamed of how so many pages are lovingly filled in with every line and freckle of Bucky's face. "Go ahead," he says. Rachel grins wide as she oohs and ahs. She pauses at the first portrait of Bucky, the most recent one that he actually managed to sit still for, and glances up at Steve, raising an eyebrow. For once, she contains herself from pressing for more information, when Steve simply says, "That's my best friend. My roommate." She studies each page with such attention, and Steve will not let himself feel awkward or embarrassed. Artists are used to people looking at their work, after all. "You're an artist," Rachel declares again. "Who's an artist?" says some fella, sliding into the stool next to Steve's. The clientele at Sully's tends to be a little older, 30s and 40s maybe. But this guy might only have a handful of years on Steve. He's probably Puerto Rican, with dark eyes, dark hair, brown skin, and cheekbones even sharper than Bucky's. "Steve," says Rachel. "Meet Raoul." "Raoul, that's Steve." "Steve the artist," says Raoul, reaching out to shake his hand. "Pleased to meet you." "Yeah, sure," replies Steve. It gets complicated again, with Raoul calling him an artist. Steve's back to feeling like a phony, but he manages to return the firm handshake and not blush. Rachel pours Raoul a beer without being asked. She slides the sketchbook across the bar top towards Steve, and Raoul shamelessly tries to get a peek of Bucky napping on their couch. "Hey, you're pretty good," says Raoul, as Steve glares and snaps up the sketchbook. "Ever draw anything blue?" Steve almost says no, but then doesn't. Instead, he asks, "You paying?" And that's how he ends up agreeing to draw completely illegal and totally blush-worthy pictures for three separate bar patrons in one afternoon. Steve Rogers, queer artist, drawer of dirty pictures. Lord. Rachel is not Bucky. She did not help nurse Steve back from the brink of death for the first time when she was 8 years old. She does not panic whenever Steve sneezes. She does not treat him like he's fragile, and Steve is determined to keep it that way. So he gets out all his coughing before he pushes open the door to Sully's. It's nothing, just a frog in his throat. But Bucky would fret if he heard it, and he doesn't want to encourage any fretting in his new friend Rachel. It's just afternoon, and there are a handful of workers eating at the bar. Today Rachel made some sort of stew, something thick and Irish, and smelling just like his mother's kitchen. He nods at a few familiar faces. Raoul and Peter. He owes them a sketch. Before looking towards his usual stool at the end of the bar. Someone is already perched there, chatting with Rachel. She's got her sketchbook open and is talking rapidly, gesturing wildly with her hands. The man before her nods back and scribbles something right there on Rachel's papers. Steve doesn't want to interrupt. He also doesn't want to sit somewhere else on his own. The fellas here are nice enough, but he learned real quick that sitting away from Rachel was the same as asking to be cruised. Which is not always a bad thing. Sometimes it's nice to have someone so obviously interested in him, even if he has yet to find the courage to try anything with anyone who isn't Bucky. But mostly fellas talk to him like he's a fairy, just because he's small. Like he wants a reminder that he's weak and tiny. Steve! Rachel catches sight of him loitering awkwardly by the door. Shalom. Hi, says Steve, coming over to the bar. The man Rachel's talking to is older, closer to Sully's age. He's greying around the temples and well-groomed, maybe Italian. He smiles at Steve like they know each other, easy and warm. Hello, says Steve, extending a hand. I'm Steve. The man grins wider and chuckles, returning the handshake. Frank. Good to meet you, Steve says, settling down on a stool as Rachel pours him a drink. Sure. Frank turns back to Rachel. He flips the sketchbook closed and slides it across the bar. Any other questions, Miss Rosenbaum? Don't you call me that, Rachel says, going from happy to tense in a breath of a few seconds. It's too Jewish. You just said shalom instead of hello, says Frank. A bad habit in need of breaking. Rachel turns away to clean an already sparkling glass. It's a bad day to be a Jew in Brooklyn. That makes every hair stand up on Steve's arms, a shiver running up his spine. Frank reaches over the bar to squeeze Rachel's shoulder. On rougher nights, Steve's seen Rachel spit fire at drunken men who were indiscriminate about their cruising and put a hand on her shoulder near the end of the night. But Rachel just leans into Frank's touch. Come by early on Saturday, he says. I don't have any appointments until 11. We'll have a few hours to work before that, if you can manage to be on time for once. Rachel cracks a smile. Thanks, Frank. Frank stands, nodding at Steve and slipping on his jacket. He winds his way through the bar, disappearing into the private office to use the back exit instead of the front. Friend of Sully's? Steve asks. You really don't recognize him like that, huh? Says Rachel. That's actually kind of comforting. What? You've met Frank before, she says. Only at the time she was in a flashy dress and going by Claudette. Steve's mouth falls open. That was Claudette? Well, today and most days he goes by Frank. But yes, same person. Whoa, she cleans up nice. Rachel giggles into her hands. I'll tell him you said so. Frank's known Sully forever. He's the tailor I was telling you about, the one I've been helping out on weekends. We're starting on one of my designs. Rachel spends the next half an hour showing Steve her sketches for the dress, including Frank's scribbled notations. He compliments her figure drawing, genuinely impressed by the progress she's made. By the end of the conversation, she seems nearly as happy as she did before she called her Hebrew a bad habit. Steve hates to make her frown again like that, but he's gotta know. Rachel, he says, trying to be gentle. Why is it a bad time to be a Jew in Brooklyn? Rachel sighs and rummages around under the bar, producing a wrinkled newspaper. She taps on a specific article, and Steve reads out loud. Over 2,000 members and sympathizers of the pro-Nazi German-American Bund meet at Prospect Hall. 200 from the American League for Peace and Democracy pick outside. Right here in Brooklyn, Rachel whispers. Over 2,000 Bund. Do you remember in the spring, when four Germans carved a swastika into some poor Jew's back? The radio announcer. Steve does not remember. He's been so focused on simply surviving since his ma died that he's barely paid attention to anything outside of his immediate surroundings. Sure, he's heard enough about Hitler on the radio to know that the man is a bully and a tyrant, but Europe is so far away. This is different. They could walk to Prospect Hall. Steve might not pay much attention to the wider world, but he's got enough experience with bullies to know that they don't simply stop on their own. Someone's got to make them. Well, everyone said it was an anomaly, Rachel says. Brooklyn's full of Democrats and lefties. No Nazis here. Except now we've got 2,000 Bund meeting openly in our own backyard. Europe's troubles won't cross the Atlantic, they say. Sure they won't. Rachel, Steve stops talking abruptly when he realizes he's got no clue what to say. I'm sorry. It's awful. Please be careful out there. It's all meaningless. No words enough to give her any comfort or peace. A customer at the other end of the bar calls out for a refill, and Rachel takes a deep breath, steadying herself before moving away to do her job with a smile on her face. Steve watches her and feels sick to his stomach, nauseous and faint and afraid. Steve was not one of those 2,000 Bund meeting at Prospect Hall, but he wasn't a picketer either. He's learned this lesson over and over. Sitting silent as a bully pounds on the little guy is just as bad as doing the pounding yourself. Until this moment, Steve never thought to apply this to the great wide world. He's been so focused on the bully right in front of him, he completely ignored the people with the real power. He was so angry and righteous when he was a kid. Maybe if his ma didn't die, if he and Bucky didn't have to focus everything on not starving to death during those hard years, Steve would have had the energy to stay that righteous. Maybe he would have been one of those protesters, instead of part of the willfully ignorant majority, turning a blind eye to the injustice going on right in their backyard. Steve's ignorance in this is just unacceptable, and he fully intends on telling Rachel so, on working himself up to a good rant. But when Rachel comes back, she holds up a hand and says, "Don't even start." "But..." "No, I don't want to think about it anymore. You know how you can help? Distract me. Talk about something else. Something to help me forget all about it." Steve blinks at her for a few seconds, desperately trying to come up with a topic. As usual, when his mind is left to its own devices, it reverts back to Bucky. "You know my best friend's Jewish," he blurts out. Rachel raises one eyebrow and smirks. Steve blushes a little, because that ain't much of a subject change, and usually he works really hard not to mention Bucky to Rachel, because something happens to his face when he talks about Bucky, and Rachel just knows. When Steve says, "My roommate, my best pal, this kid I grew up with," Rachel smirks and says, "Your friend, huh? You must be a real good friend, huh? Tell me more about this friend, why don't you?" And loving Bucky quietly, secretly, in his own head is pathetic enough. He doesn't need Rachel to know he's obsessed with someone he can't ever have again. "This the guy you live with?" Rachel asks. "Your best pal, who's apparently only your friend." Steve, predictably, blushes even harder. "Yeah," Steve says, brushing his bangs to the side. "Well, not really Jewish. His dad's a Jew, Mum's Irish Catholic. Growing up, he was in church every Sunday. Don't think he ever went to the Jew version, except on High Holy Holidays to make his bubbe happy. Rachel rolls her eyes. Synagogue. It's called a synagogue. You got High Holy Days, but you don't know synagogue? Right. Synagogue. Technically, he'd only be Jewish if his mum is. But I don't know. Having a Jewish dad was probably enough to get him called nasty names plenty of times. Yeah, Steve says, wincing. Being Irish is enough for that too. Sure, but no one's carving swastikas into our backs. Rachel looks sad again, and Steve can't bear it. She asks for a subject change, a distraction, and Steve just made it worse. Surely, there's a topic of conversation that will both distract her and cheer her up. There is exactly one thing that Rachel has shown genuine, smirking, delighted interest in. Over and over, she perks right up whenever he mentions Bucky, even in the most roundabout of ways. And why shouldn't he tell Rachel? She's the only person he's ever met that he could tell. And maybe it's not embarrassment that's kept him from even uttering Bucky's name in this place. He's so conditioned to not talk about him and Bucky that telling Rachel about this part of his life, arguably the biggest part of his life, never seemed like an option until this moment. His name is James, Steve says, wiping his suddenly sweaty palms on his trousers. He's never told Rachel his own last name, and he certainly ain't gonna give her Bucky's. There's a lot more Jameses running around Brooklyn than Bucky's. Rachel stands up straight, her eyes bulging slightly as she stares at him. He's been my best pal since we were small. Grew up on the same block. My ma knew his ma from church. And from, you know, just being Irish. But they got close after we started hanging around each other all the time. We were basically family, after that. My ma and I joining them for holidays and stuff. Even after his dad's business took off and they moved somewhere nicer. Steve's babbling. He pauses to take a deep breath and peek up at Rachel's face. She's smiling a little. I love him, Steve says, shrugging, because it really is that simple. Rachel squeezes his hand. Okay, she whispers. Steve takes a deep breath and flops down to rest his forehead on the sticky bar top. Rachel pats his back, leaves to pour more drinks, and then pats his back a few more times before he summons the courage to lift his head and keep on talking about Bucky. A month later, when Steve reads in the paper about Kristallnacht, he neglects his plans to spend the day doing laundry and rushes to the bar first thing. Sully's standing behind it, looking grim as always. It's rare to see him here this early in the day, and Steve freezes in the doorway at the sight of him. Sully just shakes his head and leads Steve into the back room, gesturing towards the staircase. Third floor, he murmurs, squeezing Steve's shoulder and going back to the bar. Rachel lets him in only a second after a knock, almost like he's expected. He's never seen her without her face perfectly painted, and without the red lipstick, she looks younger. Her hair is flat, and she's actually wearing slacks for once, and an ill-fitted shirt that looks like it might belong to Sully. A scarf is wrapped around her neck. Even though Sully keeps their apartment far hotter than Steve and Bucky could afford with theirs, Rachel's shivering. Hi, Steve says, at a loss for words. Hi, Rachel replies, stepping aside and letting him in. They spend the morning on the sofa, Rachel crying on his shoulder. When he gets home that night, when Bucky asks why he didn't do the laundry, Steve can't manage a lie. The Nazis burned down a bunch of Jewish buildings all over Germany, he says, collapsing next to Bucky on the sofa. Bucky looks exhausted, slouched way down, with his head against the back cushions, like he's ready to fall asleep right there. I got distracted. Yeah, I know. Bucky frowns, turning to face him. I went to see my bubby after work. You did? It's not as shocking as if Bucky announced that he went to see his father, but Bucky doesn't even speak much Yiddish. George always had to translate between his mother and his children. Bucky shrugs. Have you seen her since we left? Yeah, I go over there every couple months. She gets upset, you know? Likes to feed me way too much and hold my hand. Bucky's cheeks turn a little pink, like he's embarrassed. That's real nice, Steve murmurs. I didn't know you did that, but it's real nice. Could have swore I told you. Nope, I didn't know. Huh. Steve shifts, mimicking Bucky's position. He curls in on himself a little, until it feels like he and Bucky are in a protective little bubble, where no one can touch them. A month ago, 2000 Bund met at Prospect Hall, he whispers. Yeah, Bucky says, closing his eyes. And last spring, someone carved a swastika into that radio broadcaster's back. Yeah. But you knew all that, didn't you? Steve murmurs. He always thought it was the both of them, too wrapped up in just getting through the week to pay much attention to anything else. But Bucky knows. Bucky reads the paper. Bucky's careful. Bucky doesn't have the luxury of not paying attention, because 2000 Bund in their backyard want to hurt him. Hey, I only know a few words in Yiddish, but I get what my bubby means when she points at the paper and then grabs my collar and begs me to be careful. Yeah, Steve murmurs. But someone's got to stop them. Right, Bucky? Right. It's got to stop at some point. I don't know, pal. They sit in silence on the sofa for a long time, before they get up to do the laundry together. Chanukah starts at sundown tomorrow, Rachel says, before Steve even takes a seat on his stool. Chanukah, he asks, unwrapping Bucky's scarf from around his neck. He shivers and shakes the snow off his hat. Jewish holiday? Festival of Lights? Really? You got nothing? Your best friend is half a Jew and you don't even know about Chanukah? It's no Rosh Hashanah, but even so. She shakes her head, apparently very disappointed. Sorry, Rach. He dumps all his warm clothes on the stool next to his. Winter is in full swing outside, snow falling thick and heavy, the streets miserable and wet. He's never much talked about what they did, the few times a year they went to see his pop's side of the family. Did you ever see one of these? She asks, pulling out a little pewter candle holder and placing it on the bar. It's a menorah. Yeah, actually. You light one every night for a while, right? Around Christmas time. They definitely did that. He studies the menorah. It's tarnished and dented, much smaller than the Barnes' slightly more elaborate version that sat on their mantel. It hits him suddenly that this is yet another part of himself that Bucky gave up when he left home with Steve. He was always more Catholic than Jewish, his ma insistent on Mass every Sunday, when his father only insisted on synagogue a few times a year. Steve might not have seen it much, but this religion was part of Bucky's life, before. He used to practice a few Yiddish phrases to communicate with his grandma, and he kept a flat little Jewish hat in the top drawer of his dresser, next to a rosary. These days, when they're feeling homesick and nostalgic, they'll go to Mass even without a stern note from Winnie requesting their presence. But Bucky's got nowhere to turn when he starts missing the Jewish part of his old life. Where can I get one of these? Steve asks, running his fingertips over the first narrow candle holder. Rachel beams, like she was both hoping and expecting him to ask that question. Keep that one. No, Rachel, I couldn't. You can, and you will. Give it to your friend. You said he doesn't see his family much since you guys moved out, right? Light a candle tomorrow. I'll write out a blessing for you. It's yours. I've got a nicer one upstairs, Rachel says, shrugging. She starts wiping down the bar top with a rag, even though it's perfectly clean for once. I stole my bubbe's menorah when I ran away. That's the one my ma gave me. And my ma is terrible. I don't want it. You're doing me a favour taking it off my hands. Honest. When Steve's ready to go home, a few blue drawings and a couple hours later, he carefully wraps the menorah in his scarf. Rachel comes around the bar to say goodbye, and he hugs her a few beats longer than he normally would. Merry Chanukah, Rachel. She lets out a delighted laugh, saying, and a happy Christmas to you. Then she shoos him out of the bar with recommendations on where to buy candles. Bucky stares at the menorah sitting on the board over the bathtub in their kitchen for a long time before the silence becomes too much and Steve starts to jabber. I know, you're not really Jewish because your ma ain't, and you never had a bar mitzvah, Steve says, wringing his hands and pacing the length of the kitchen. And I know you never really believed in the God stuff, no matter what version. Bucky raises an eyebrow, obviously amused and surprised by Steve's new knowledge. Really? He's just directly quoting Rachel. But you did this stuff growing up, right? Steve continues. With your tate? You'd do the holiday stuff, go to your grandma's and spend the important days with that side of the family. Sure. Bucky speaks slowly and studies Steve like this whole thing is a great big mystery in need of solving. Just thought you might miss it, is all, Steve says, shrugging. He deeply regrets ever asking Rachel for the menorah. It's too strange. Bucky's never said much about the Jewish half of his family, never said much about Judaism at all. He's yelled obscenities and punched out the teeth of nasty boys who called him all manner of names when they were in school. And he's joked over the unlikely love between his parents, the strange life his Catholic mother and Jewish father made together. But he's never offered much of an opinion on his own limited connection to this religion that still seems foreign and strange to Steve. You don't have to keep it, he whispers. But Bucky's hand finds the base, holding it to the tabletop as he shakes his head. He says, got a candle. And his face seems awfully content in the flickering flame when they light it at sundown. They spend Christmas alone, just the two of them, for the third year in a row. Bucky suggests midnight mass, making a face like the whole world smells bad. And Steve says, why bother? Neither of us are very good Catholics. They make it until about 11, both of them feeling twitchy and nervous, sitting on the couch listening to the radio and not talking. Let's just go, Bucky finally says, groaning. It doesn't feel like Christmas without Mass. Moments like this, when guilt and nostalgia have them seeking out church, they always go all the way to Visitation Church in Red Hook. All the Buchanans will be at Assumption. And Bucky's been avoiding church and his mother since the Mary Ann incident. Going anywhere else in the neighbourhood is just asking to run into someone they know. At Visitation, they are anonymous. And Steve might not believe in any of it, in God even. But recently he's grown to appreciate the ritual. There is something so comforting about Mass, about communion. Latin and incense remind him of his mother. The walk home is bitterly cold, and Steve shivers in his coat, even with the three sweaters Bucky insisted he layer underneath. This was a dumb fucking idea, Bucky mutters, pulling him close and rubbing his arm. Too fucking cold for you to be out here. I'm fine, Buck. Steve hears the shivers in his own voice as he speaks, but he turns his face towards Bucky, and he means it anyway. The next day, he's sniffling over the Christmas roast Bucky's prepared for them. It's nothing they could imagine affording even last year, even though they'd already been living in the apartment for a few months. By New Year's, Steve's too exhausted to sit up in bed for more than 5 minutes at a time. He's felt it coming on for days, starting with a tickle in his throat that he valiantly ignored, until the tickle became a scratch, and clearing his throat turned into full-blown coughing after Bucky's alarm woke him. If he could have held off for 5 minutes more, Bucky would have been off to work. But instead, Steve starts hacking, just after Bucky's pulling on his jacket. "I'm fine," Steve says, before Bucky can even open his mouth. He simply shoots Steve a look of deep skepticism, his eyebrows going up and his lips pressing into a flat line. "It's just a cold," Steve insists, doing an excellent job of sitting up against his pillows and smiling, like he doesn't want to claw out his sore throat just to stop it hurting. Bucky rolls his eyes, crossing the room and getting a finger under Steve's chin. At Bucky's coaxing, Steve tilts his face up, Bucky's scrutiny making his cheeks burn. "You're a little hot," Bucky murmurs, laying a palm over Steve's forehead. Steve bites out a hysterical laugh. "Just a cold," he repeats. "Yeah, how many times have I heard that just before you end up in hospital, or some schmuck of a priest's reading you last rites?" "Oh, come on, Bark. Just take it easy today, all right?" It's another foolish moment, with Bucky looking down at Steve, and Steve looking up at Bucky, where Steve's breath catches in his chest, and he thinks maybe they're both remembering what it was like to press their lips together. But then Steve starts coughing again, worse and wetter this time. Bucky rubs his back until Steve manages to get him out of the door before Bucky will be too terribly late for work. He's worse when Bucky gets home, bad off enough that he can admit that he will not be participating in their elaborate plans to celebrate New Year's Eve, plans that involve getting drunk in a variety of neighborhood bars. "Don't think I'm going to make it out tonight, pal," Steve says, after he finishes guzzling down a glass of water at Bucky's insistence. Bucky snorts and takes the glass. "You don't say." "Jerk," Steve says. Bucky just grins at him, pushing his damp bangs off his forehead. "Think you're up for laying out on the couch at least?" "No, I'm just going to sleep in here while you go out." "I ain't going out," Bucky says. Like Steve is very stupid, and this should be very obvious. "You were all excited to kiss a dame at midnight." "I'll make do." So Steve moves to the couch, and Beck comes over, bearing a deck of cards and a bottle of wine she stole from the party raging at her parents' house. Bucky sits on the floor, leaning back against the sofa, his head close enough to Steve that he could reach out and run his fingers through his hair. Beck sits across the floor from Bucky with the coffee table between them, and they play cards. Steve drifts in and out, but he's aware enough at midnight to ring in the new year. Bucky drags Beck into a hug as she squeals and puts up a half-hearted protest. He kisses her on each cheek, saying, "I love you, I love you." He turns to Steve next, hovering above him where Steve's still laid out on the sofa. The light behind his head brings out the red and gold in his hair, makes him look like an angel, with his cheeks all pink with wine. Steve, feverish and nearing delirium, beams at him, wants to touch. "It's 1939, he says. "We made it to 1939. Bucky nods and leans down, pressing a lingering kiss to Steve's forehead. He murmurs, "I love you. I love you."